From KCUR, this is Up to Date with Steve Kraske. I'm producer Hallie Jackson. It's an election year, and as we get closer and closer to November, you'll probably start seeing the results of more and more polls, reporting all types of results. But how do pollsters conduct their studies, and how do we know what to make of the results? To answer some of these questions, Steve spoke with two people who regularly measure public opinion in Kansas and Missouri. Steve Rogers is the director of the St. Louis University YouGov poll, and Michael Smith is a professor of political science at Emporia State University who works on the Kansas Speaks survey. Let's listen.
So polling has changed a lot, you know, in the last two decades or so. You know, tech changes have posed some pretty big challenges to the way that you do your work. Michael, in your view, has it gotten harder to get an accurate gauge of public opinion?
It hasn't necessarily gotten harder. You just have to do it differently.
What do you mean by that?
Well, telephone polling is mostly obsolete. A lot of people no longer have landlines. Their area codes may not correspond to where they're currently living.
So why don't you just call them on their cells?
Well, we do sometimes, but the problem is call screening is so ubiquitous now. So what we do now is often contract with one of two companies. Qualtrics is one of them. That's the one Kansas Speaks uses. Or an Amazon service called Mechanical Turk or MTurk. And what they do is they maintain a pool of respondents, which are demographically representative of populations. They have a huge pool. And then when you contract with them, it costs money, but of course it costs money to do telephone polling too. They draw a sample and then you write the questions and they administer it and then deliver the results.
And is that easier to do it that way because that pool of names is available just for a fee?
That's right. And typically the questions are answered online now.
Yeah.
You have to make sure you're doing the right sampling. You can't just have what's called a convenience sample and send out emails and say forward this. It has to be more of a scientific process.
Yeah.
But you get pretty good results.
Steve, do you agree with Michael that maybe things haven't really gotten that much harder for pollsters?
So here, I do think like Michael's actually is accurate in which that pretty much what we have to do has changed. And then in this, there were challenges when we kind of did phone polling, and now there are challenges when we do online polling. And so then here, if we're just kind of thinking about some of these challenges, yes, using the internet can be a little bit more convenient. We can have basically more demographics about people before we contact them. But it's important to consider that not everybody necessarily has the same sort of internet access. And so when we're talking about states like Missouri or Kansas, there's probably a lot more rural areas. And out here, I'm more familiar with Missouri, but in this, the more rural areas typically don't have as good of internet access to, say, broadband. And so in this, this can present like a new challenge kind of for pollsters in which we're trying to be sure that we contact all these audiences.
Although Governor Mike Parson is saying, Steve, that he's going to extend broadband access broadly to rural Missouri in the years to come, right?
No, yes. And so there's active pursuits to make rural access, internet access more accessible in the rural areas. But even if we kind of go back to the pandemic, and so there's a lot of studies done about how many schools or school districts kind of had access to reliable broadband. And at least in Missouri, 94% of city and suburban school districts had reliable access to broadband, but only 22% of school districts kind of in the rural areas did.
Wow.
And so this is looking at school districts, and so it's not the best unit of measurement for polling necessarily. But I think it is a little bit reflective that there are going to be audiences that we just have to exert a little bit extra effort to reach or different methodologies in order to account for them.
You know, Michael, I want to get this question out of the way early on here because I hear this all the time when we talk about polling. People often say, hey, I've never been contacted to take part in a poll, so how can they be legit? I've been voting for 40 years and no one's ever called me. What do you say to that?
Well, Steve, my good friend Erica Martin, who's been on this show, teaches biology at Emporia State, and she does water quality sampling. Now, when she samples the Neosho River, she does not take all of the water in the entire river back to the lab and test it. That would be absurd. She takes what are called samples. So they have to come from different points. They have to come in different seasons, different depths, all kinds of considerations for how she samples that water. She then tests the samples and draws an inference to the quality of the water in the river.
Mm-hmm.
This is exactly what public opinion polling is. We dip our cup in different parts of the population, people that graduated from high school, school, people that didn't, urban, rural, different races, genders, counties, you name it. And then we draw inferences. Now, are the inferences perfect? No. And too often, public opinion polls are reported, the results, without the statistics that go with it, so you can draw an inference. But that has to do with how they're reported. That doesn't mean that public opinion polling isn't valid.
And that has to do with something called margin of error, where you say President Biden has 48% support and Donald Trump has 47%, but there's a 3% margin of error, meaning that either of those numbers could vary by that number, right?
Well, that's exactly right. Essentially, what you're looking at with poll results is an interval in which you're confident, not 100% confident, but an interval in which it's likely that the results for the whole population fall within that interval. Now, there's a small chance it doesn't, but there are workarounds to that too, such as amalgamating the results of multiple public opinion polls.
Yeah. Steve, I wanted to ask you, you survey likely voters. What does that mean, and why do you do it that way?
So we are, so what we do at the SLUGov poll is that we do a poll, like two polls a year, and then in this, what we kind of draw from, kind of as Michael like discussed earlier, is then we have a potential pool of respondents, or in the biology terms, the ocean of respondents, and then we draw a sample, and in the sample that we're drawing is that we're drawing first registered voters. And then what we do is then we kind of ask the voters themselves, it's like, okay, how likely are you to vote in the upcoming election? And so then here we do this probably for two reasons. One reason is that sometimes we do poll on elections themselves, and then the population that we're kind of interested in is those people who are actually going to vote than necessarily all Missourians. And then additionally, what we're also interested in is like kind of speaking to policymakers. And then these policymakers themselves may have a little bit more of an electoral focus in terms of like, okay, what are the voters who are going to vote me in or out of office going to necessarily be thinking? And so we just want to kind of, we are aiming to limit our sample to those who are probably most likely to kind of participate in the electoral process.
Steve, what do you do, if you can't get responses from certain demographic groups? I think that's where this idea of weighting the results comes in. But can you explain that to us?
Sure. And so then here, what weighting is to address the problem you kind of raised. Like, we may not necessarily be able to get, like, say, respondents that are proportional to the population in terms of demographics. And so here, maybe just like as an example, like say we basically know that 50% of the population is women, 50% of the population is men. But say, for example, we just have 55% women respond to our poll and then 45% men.
Right.
So that's like our makeup. And so then what we can do is through like statistical procedures is just kind of downweight women's responses and then upweight men's responses. So every man's response is going to count for a little bit more, and then every woman's response is going to count for a little bit less when we kind of produce the final number. And so here, this is kind of a simple example in terms of gender, but then what we can do also is kind of look at census demographics, say voter registration rolls, and kind of know what the demographics are of our population in terms of, say, African American, Hispanic, and white, how educated you are, in order to try to basically correct for basically if our sample that we actually interview is not perfectly representative. We can do like a post-interview adjustment in order to basically account that we have basically accurate proportions of each demographic.
You know, Michael Smith, there's people who are listening to what Steve is having to say there, and they're thinking to themselves, hey, see, that's what's wrong with polls. These guys are manipulating the numbers behind the scenes before they present their final results. What would you say to that?
It is possible to skew polling results. And
easy. It's easy to do, actually.
It is. And in fact, we report the unweighted data, too. So we have what you see is what you get with Kansas Speaks. If you want to see the unweighted data, you can see it. There are some of the workarounds for that. One of my favorites, again, is amalgamating public opinion polls. So you're not relying on one. If you've heard of Nate Silver, the polling guru, that's what he does. And he was one of the few that predicted that Donald Trump could win in 2016. Mm-hmm. And that's how he did that. So why use just one poll when you have many? And you can use formulas for that and so on and so forth. But one of the problems we hit, which, for example, in 2016, Steve, was that we weighted based on the turnout in the previous election, which was 2012. Well, not the same people turned out. Donald Trump actually mobilized people to vote for and against him.
Mm-hmm.
Happened again in 2020.
And that's where pollsters got it a little bit wrong.
Right, because it wasn't an attempt to throw the the election. What it was is that we were using 2012 weights and we didn't adjust for the turnout changes between 2012 and 2016. So it's not an exact science. If you have the money, and of course this takes still more resources, but amalgamating multiple public opinion polls is the way to go.
Meaning sort of taking a look at four or five polls and averaging them all together to see what a broad swath of the country is thinking.
That's exactly right. And another point I would make on that, we were talking about margin of error earlier. If you see really close results, and particular little shifts, like, well, yesterday it was Biden 49, Trump 51, and today it's, you know, Biden 51, Trump 49. What that means is that the election is within the margin of error. It's too close to call. And one of the things that some reporters, Steve, not you, of course, do is they report that there's been a change.
Mm-hmm.
But that's sampling error. That's,
right.
That's all that is.
I get the sense, Steve, that polls are always going to wind up having some sort of respondent bias, meaning you're never going to have a perfect sample that perfectly represents the demographics of the country.
No, so here there will very likely always be some sort of sampling bias, as you indicate. But here, kind of like to echo Michael's points in terms of trying to identify these stronger polls. So like similar to in Kansas, the SLU YouGov poll also puts all of our data online and items like that, so everybody can kind of go and download it. And so then here, if like listeners are kind of interested, like how do I kind of judge a good poll or bad? One thing that is very important to kind of look at is how transparent are they?
Mm-hmm.
Because here, if you're concerned, if like, oh, did the demographics match up, the person or the reader of the poll should be able to go look and be kind of seeing, it's like, okay, so how many African Americans are in the sample? How many women are in the sample? How many people with a college degree are in the sample? And so in this is like, it'd be very difficult for any pollster, whether doing an online poll or a phone poll, to get a perfectly representative sample. There's always been bias in polls. But in this, it's important to know is like, how is the pollster correcting for these bias through
mm-hmm.
things like weighting, like we talked about earlier?
Right.
And then additionally, what data are they actually working with? So that transparency.
Okay. Let's go to Evelyn from Green Valley. Evelyn, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, yes. I had a question. So I am a Gen Xer, and between me and all of my friends, we screen calls, and all of us, between work and texting, have basically been taught, hey, don't click a link unless you know where it's coming from.
Right.
So how do you guys plan on adjusting what you do to basically get better buy-in from my generation?
Michael, young people aren't answering the phones. I see it all the time in my students.
Well, thanks for calling Gen X young people.
Yeah.
That's me too. I appreciate that, Steve.
Yeah.
But seriously, again, telephone polling is pretty much obsolete. Most people use Qualtrics or MTurk now. And yes, people have agreed ahead of time to be in the pool. They're not randomly chosen. Well, they're initially randomly chosen, but they have to agree to be in the pool. So when they get the emails and other contacts, maybe a nudge, hey, don't forget to answer, they have agreed ahead of time. So that's going to bypass their spam filters. They've signed up and chosen to do this.
Right. Okay, let's go to Bill from Kansas City. Bill, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I got two questions regarding Gen Z and one regarding the abortion. When I was looking at the polls last year, year before in Kansas, it seemed a lot of Republican women had come out and voted and were not, it was not caught on the polling by even Nate Silver, if I remember right. That's one question. If you could explain in Missouri what's going on currently with the abortion potentially being on the ballot, how you think the local and national races, for example, the senators, I'm not even caring about Biden right now because I doubt he wins in Missouri. The other one would be on the Gen Z.
Let me slow you down, Bill. Let me get your first question answered about maybe the undersampling of Republican women who voted on that abortion amendment in Kansas a couple years ago. Michael, what would you say to that?
Well, I'm very proud to say that Kansas Speaks was pretty much right on. I thought I was a skeptic. I thought that the questions were going to skew our data to pro-choice and we were going to undersample anti-abortion voters. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. Kansas Speaks in 2021, 2022 was pretty much right on with that. Quick comment about Republicans. It is true that Trump supporters in particular distrust universities and the news media. Well, who does most public opinion polls? Universities and the news media. So they do are more likely to refuse and they get undersampled. So that's where that waiting piece. It's one of the places where that waiting piece comes in.
Bill, give me your second question again, if you would.
I think this one may be a little more important to me anyway. The Gen Z, I heard even Nate Siller talking about why there's a greater error in sampling the Gen Z, because even though they are agreed to be in part of the polling, they're not returning their polls, and so it's been biased significantly. And so it's even in some polls showing that they're favoring Trump, whereas we all know most of these guys are in school or the younger generation is a little more progressive, if the best word I can use. So how do you get around that problem in polling is what I'm asking.
Yeah, Steve, would you take that, the challenge of sampling younger people like the Gen Zers?
No, so I think this is a problem that's going to be in terms of sampling any like smaller group. And so, for example, what pollsters do try to do often is achieve enough of a sample size in which that we can kind of have like a reasonable margin of error, a reasonable amount of confidence, kind of as Michael spoke earlier about. But that amount of confidence is going to be largely kind of focused on the whole population, or like, say, the likely voters in Missouri or the likely voters in Kansas. But then when we're trying to get in down into these subgroups, we have to kind of recognize that we are getting to many fewer people. And so, for example, like if we look at the raw unweighted ends of that of the last SLU YouGov poll, overall we surveyed about 900 people, but then only about, say, 65 of these people were in between the ages of 18 and 29. And so then in this, like this is reflective of it's harder to kind of reach these individuals. But then, as Michael spoke about earlier, what that's going to mean is that there's going to be a much less certainty about those specific subgroup results. And so then when interpreting these results about, say, was Gen Z supporting Donald Trump or are people of color more likely to support Donald Trump, there is some like rational reasons or reasonable reasons that we may expect this, whether it be what's going on in Israel-Palestine or, say, just changing demographics of the parties. But we just want to be conscientious of it's like, okay, when we're making these statements about subgroups, how many people are actually in the subgroup that we're making an inference of? Because if we had like 900 Gen Zers in the poll, I would be much more confident to kind of make an inference about Gen Zers than I would if I only have less than 100.
When we come back, more on how polling works and what you need to know when you come across them.
You know, Michael, another thing I wanted to ask about before we lose our time here is that the way that questions in these polls are written obviously is critical to getting the accurate responses that you're reaching for. I know that's something that you think about a lot. What kinds of considerations do you have in this sense when it comes to crafting questions for the Kansas Speak survey?
It takes a lot of training. I first started studying polling when I was a graduate student at the University of Missouri and worked in the Survey Research Center. And you'd poll subsamples and then you'd look at the results and tweak the questions. And it really is, it's an art and not a science in many ways. You just have to go to great pains to make sure that the wording is neutral. People are amazingly sensitive. A quick example, if I may, back during the Obama presidency, they took a sample in Kentucky and they partitioned it. One group was asked about their opinions of the Affordable Care Act, and the other was asked their opinions about Obamacare. Now, you and I know that those are the same thing. Obamacare is a nickname for the Affordable Care Act, but the Affordable Care Act was far more popular than Obamacare because voters were queuing in on the words.
Yeah.
There's also a priming effect, which questions you ask first prime people for what to expect.
And oftentimes, don't you ask multiple questions about a topic to try to suss out if there's a nuance to an issue that voters are facing?
You do. You do. For example, in Kansas Speaks, we're now asking questions about gun policy, and we're getting some really remarkable answers that essentially show that a lot of Kansans are pretty moderate on this. Mm-hmm. They support the Second Amendment, but also certain restrictions on gun ownership.
You know, Steve, how often do the results of your polls surprise you?
No, so there's at times that they do surprise me and other times that they do not. So Missouri and I think Kansas are particularly a little bit more red states. But here, for example, like actually the SLU Gov poll has also polled on, say, guns and gun control issues. And then here, for example, we found in the SLU Gov poll that over like 79% of voters in Missouri are in favor of criminal background checks, mental health, 69% for mental health background checks. And so there's actually a lot of support even in this red state for some policies that we may consider to be a little bit more progressive. But probably one thing that surprised me is that on many things, even red flag laws, 60% of Missouri voters are in favor of instituting this gun control. However, they are still very strongly for their Second Amendment rights. Like only 7% of voters want to ban all guns. Only 10% of voters want to ban handguns. Not even a majority of voters, only 39% of voters want to ban semi-automatic weapons. And so at least that was like one finding kind of digging into these issues and the nuance of Missourians' opinions in which they kind of want more gun control. However, they still want to protect their Second Amendment right to have the right to own a gun.
Steve, do you walk away from some of these results thinking that, hey, maybe Missourians aren't as extreme as our elected officials would make it seem sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. And so that's actually probably one of the missions of the SLU YouGov poll is to provide this nuance to public opinion. So I just kind of told you about guns, but then abortion is an issue that Kansas is facing. It's going to be very likely on the Missouri ballot in the upcoming election. And in here, for example, we found that even in this red state, that 60% of Democrats, independents, and Republicans, for example, are in favor of having a woman have a legal right to an abortion in cases of rape, incest, or life of mother. And so right now, Missouri, as your listeners probably know, has a pretty comprehensive ban on abortions.
Right.
But there's many circumstances in which even in this red state that Missourians do want to maybe have a different policy than what the policymakers have made.
I was going to say, Missouri residents were asked what they think should be the top priority of state government. Abortion and immigration were not mentioned by the vast majority of people. In Kansas, 58% of people who responded to a question about climate change agreed that addressing climate change should be given priority, even at the risk of slowing economic growth. That gets back to my point that maybe there's more consensus among voters than there is sometimes in the halls of the state house, Michael.
Well, that's right. We see similar results in Kansas on many issues, like on gun policy, for example. A lot of what voters are voting on are the images of the two parties. And so, for example, if you wonder, well, how did Laura Kelly get elected and reelected? Granted, in very tight elections, but at the same time, Kansas votes overwhelmingly Republican for president and Senate. I think a lot of it is the party images for the Kansas Democratic Party are very different than the ones for the national, and they don't always line up with the voters' actual stand on issues.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Sam from Paola on the Kansas side says that polling surveys often include a donation request, which can turn him off from filling out the survey. As we wrap up this segment, Michael, as people look at polls throughout the rest of this year, what should they be looking for to help them gauge whether they should take one poll more seriously than another?
First of all, your listener is absolutely right. If there's a donation request attached, throw that out.
Yeah.
Also, if you ever hear the words, if you knew, that's misleading. That's push polling. Stop the poll immediately. There is no if you knew.
And push polling is where you're trying to do what?
You're using a fake public opinion poll to try and skew public opinion.
You're using the poll to actually...
A fake poll.
To make people think a different way about an issue.
Real polls sample public opinion. I would say look for transparency. Ask who's doing it. Do they have a political agenda? How transparent are they about things like margin of error, confidence interval? Will they be upfront with you about what their poll can't do? About the limitations and short call, you know, where it falls short. Will they give you the unweighted data as well as the weighted data? And again, polling amalgamation, like with Nate Silver, look at the average of multiple polls, not a single poll.
Are there certain polls, Steve, that you would put more stock in than others? I'm thinking like Gallup, for instance.
No, yeah. So there are certain polls that I probably put more stock in than others, and then kind of echo what Michael is saying. 538, which is now run by Elliot Morris, they've in the last couple months, they've actually released a new set of pollster rankings. And so if you just kind of, if your listeners just Google 538 pollster ratings, you'll come up with a very comprehensive list that kind of accounts for both accuracy and transparency of the polls.
Interesting.
And so then here, like the top five kind of pollsters there are the New York Times Siena poll, ABC News, the Washington Post, the Marquette University Law School, YouGov, and along with the Monmouth poll.
Oh, very good.
And so then here, if users just again Google 538 pollster ratings, you'll see of a kind of a basic primer of how to assess polls themselves. And then if you really want to dig into the weeds, there's a multi-page like document that kind of says, here's all these transparency rankings, accuracy rankings, in order to kind of assess these pollsters.
That was our host, Steve Kraske, talking with Steve Rogers and Michael Smith, two pollsters who regularly measure the attitudes of people in Missouri and Kansas. Up to Date is a production of KCUR, and this episode was produced by me, Hallie Jackson. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back with more Up to Date soon.